Good evening. Welcome to tonight's program, The Tunisian Model of Revolution and the Challenges of Democracy, with Jerry Sorkin, a specialist in Middle East and North African politics and tourism. I'm Christina Namath, travel director at the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about our programs, membership, and traveling with the club, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator for tonight's program. Peter Stein is a San Francisco-based media producer and a Peabody Award-winning documentary maker. He spent 11 years as executive producer at PBS station KQED and was executive director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, the oldest and largest of its kind in the world, for which he curated hundreds of public programs on Israel and the Middle East. He now writes and produces film, media, and performing arts projects, and is a frequent onstage interviewer and film presenter. Please join me in welcoming Peter Stein.
Thank you, Christina, very much. A pleasure to be here. And back at the Commonwealth Club on an August day, 12 years ago today, September 11th, 2001, many Americans felt for the first time, against our will, viscerally affected by and connected to political affairs in an obscure corner of the world called Afghanistan. And just as today, many citizens are reluctantly looking at maps of Syria, first to find it, and then to wonder how or if a civil war there should affect our lives and security at home. So it is very fitting that tonight we get to hear from a man who has spent much of his adult life getting to know a corner of the world that few Americans know much about, but whose internal struggles and cultural richness have much to teach us about the prospects for peaceful democratic change in the post-colonial Muslim world. Jerry Sorkin is a specialist in Middle East and North African politics and tourism. He resides much of the year in Tunisia. Jerry's involvement with Tunisia dates back more than three decades. During these last two-plus years, since Tunisia's January 2011 revolution, he served as a consultant for the World Bank and was among the authors of their 2012 report on restructuring the tourism economy of Tunisia. Since the fall of 2012, Jerry has recently taken on the role as director of George Washington University's International Institute of Tourism Studies program in Tunisia. He's also the tourism consultant on a European Union project that is developing microbusinesses and jobs in an economically neglected region of Tunisia. Now, in addition to these activities, he's the founder of Tunis USA, a company specializing in designing cultural and academic tour programs and special trade delegations, not only in Tunisia, but in other countries, including Algeria, Iran, and Libya. Jerry earned both his undergraduate and graduate degrees at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in Middle East studies and international business, respectively. And he is conversant, as one would need to be if one lives most of his life in Tunisia, conversant in Arabic and French. Please join me in welcoming Jerry Sorkin.
Peter, thank you for the introduction, and Christina, thank you for inviting me here. It's a privilege to be at the Commonwealth Club and San Francisco. You're blessed with an absolutely beautiful city. I think you all know that. I flew in from Philadelphia last night, so it was nice to arrive and not have to have a visa. And then just walking over from my hotel, not only is it a beautiful city, it's a friendly city. People came up and asked if I could have a drink with them. People played guitar for me. I saw some, seems like picnics are taking place over here on North Market there. So it's, it really needs to be seen as a very friendly city, and that was impressive. I think we're all today, at some moment today, or maybe multiple moments, reflecting on the events of 12 years ago on September 11th. And also September 11th of last year, the attack of the American consulate in Benghazi was a reminder to us all, and the death of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans, of how vulnerable Americans can be, how in some corners of the world we're so hated and disliked for our values, the things that we hold to be important, and how there are different people in regions of the world that while they have values that are different than us, we've often made the same mistake of not really understanding them. And if there's anything that can come out of the terrible losses of 9/11 and the events of last year, it's that hopefully we can have a better understanding why some people dislike us so much, how we can relate to them in a better way, and what can we do to prevent incidents from happening and be able to have a better understanding of parts of the world that seem so vulnerable and can be such powder cakes. And there's no place in the world that can have the potential spark to erupt into a greater area than the Middle East. And as Peter noted, and as I think we all know from every day in the paper, now we're hearing about how we may be involved in Syria. So these are parts of the world that many of us never knew. Tunisia is a part of the world that very few Americans knew until just a few years ago. To put that in real numbers perspectives, even by Tunisia's own statistics, the amount of Americans who visited Tunisia before 2010 and spent 7 nights was probably less than 4,000. So it gives you a sense of how unknown Tunisia is to the United States. We, and I say we as Americans, and we even as our elected officials and the people who represent us in determining policies, tend to look at that region, whether it's Tunisia, Syria, Yemen, Saudi, as over there. It's them, it's the Arabs, it's the Muslims. Seldom seeing the vast differences that we are now seeing. And if I want the most recent events that have really brought a change in that part of the world, and we're seeing it now in the stories that are taking place between Egypt, Syria, and other places, were the events that took place that eventually called a movement by many of the media the Arab Spring. And just to kind of bring some of you up to how that happened, because I must tell you, living in Tunisia, there is no political pundit anywhere, no official in Tunisia, no Tunisian citizen who ever could have imagined in December 2010 that their autocratic leader, Zine Ben Ali, of 23 years, was going to one day flee and start what was the first of the so-called Arab Spring revolutions. In December 2010, there was a produce vendor in a small, dusty town of central Tunisia called Zidi Bouzid. His name was Mohamed Bouazizi. He felt his dignity was threatened because he had an education but was selling fruit and produce. And as the story goes and the reports go, that a policewoman insulted him and took away his scale and said he didn't have the right permits. And he said, all I'm trying to do is earn a living and have my dignity. And out of his frustration, as his friends tell the story, he lit himself on fire and died. And the ramifications of that led to demonstrations starting in the central part of the country that had been economically neglected for so many years and then spread to the cities. And then for the first time in Tunisia's history, they had demonstrations throughout the country that went on for weeks. And the autocratic leader, who himself had once been the Ministry of Information, the head of intelligence, seemed to find no solution that could stop what was taking place. And suddenly, on January 14, 2011, this feared autocrat got on a plane with his family in the dark of night and left. And the country erupted in a sense of joy, thinking, now we have a revolution, now we have freedom, and in fact, now people were able to speak about any political subject they wanted without having to look over their back. Psychologically, that was a dramatic change. Even President Obama, at his State of the Union address just a week later in Washington, cited this newfound freedom for this country that most people had never heard of before then, and said how we as a country want to support all these freedom movements. 11 days later, after Ben Ali left, the inspiration of what happened in Tunisia caused youth throughout Egypt to start demonstrating and calling for the downfall of Mubarak. And within 2 weeks, Mubarak, who was so steadfast for so long, also stepped down. It continued and spiraled for the next several weeks. Yemen, outpouring of people in the streets against their leadership, eventually forcing their president to resign. In Bahrain, there were demonstrations, even in this small kingdom that has really small population but lots of oil money. But yet people were frustrated. People were protesting. And this was put down very heavily by the Bahraini military backed by the Saudis. Then it went on to Libya, all within now a month from the Tunisian example. All people being inspired to take on this newfound liberty that they were seeing happening in other countries. And Libya, in a matter of 8 or 9 months, was able to throw down Gaddafi and had the support of France, the United States, and other Western powers in knocking out the air advantages of the Gaddafi government, and soon Gaddafi was killed. In March, 2 months after the Tunisian revolution, Syria demonstrations started going on and grew more and more from Damascus to other places. And I don't have to tell you what's happened since then, with over 100,000 people dead in Syria and over 3 million Syrians having left Syria and become refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and and also Iraq. So the volatility of these regions is something that has caught our government off guard, because we had a policy that was particularly strong during second Bush Jr.'s year, that we felt bringing democracy, our brand of democracy, to all these regions would be the way of changing the world, particularly after 9/11, but even before then, the idea that perhaps our brand of democracy is what was missing. But that also brings up the question of what did we really know about these regions? Could you just take our brand of democracy and bring it to people? And why did we support these autocratic leaders so long? Americans often turned a blind eye to not only the Middle East, but to autocratic leaders in many parts of the world, because they'll often serve our interests. The belief that by having a strong leader, you can, not just meaning in military strength, but by domineering people in whatever way, you can control situations and keep stability at all cost. So these friendly autocrats, the people who we saw as our friendly autocrats, were also seen as a bulwark to religious extremism, particularly Islamic extremism, the same extremism that brought about the 9/11 activists to kill so many people, almost 4,000 people on 9/11. But we have to look at how has our approach to the Middle East and North Africa, how has it served itself over these years? How successful has it been? And where does it leave us now in terms of how we look at these regions? Again, the Bush doctrine of spreading democracy is something that has not always brought success. In the 1990s, we encouraged Algeria to have free elections. And the free elections resulted in an Islamic party being elected. And we, the United States, quickly encouraged the Algerian government and its military to squelch this victory that was done freely by our encouragement. And it resulted in 10 years of Algeria's killing leftist, rightist, religious extremist military people to what eventually has been known today in Algeria as Jamaat al-Ihrab, the dark days of terrorism. Fortunately, in Algeria, things seem to be stable and have been stable, but that's after some 100,000 to 200,000 lives being lost. We encouraged in 2006 the Palestinians to have free elections, and we were hoping Fatah would be the winner. But we neglected to think that all the years of the donor money coming in following the 1995, the famous peace signing, 1993's famous peace signing on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton, Yitzhak Rabin, King Hussein, Yasser Arafat, and Bill Clinton. We thought that everyone would feel like we do, that now if the Palestinians have an election, that this freedom will bring the fresh results that we hope that will lead to better things. But Palestinians were remembering where all that donor money, hundreds of millions of dollars of donor money were going as they went to the polls. They thought about the big villas that went up throughout the West Bank, but the fact that their lives hadn't really changed. So they voted for Hamas in free elections. And Condoleezza Rice even said after the elections that she was shocked at the results. But did we fail as a intelligence, in our intelligence, to truly understand the nature of these regions to have results like that? Iraq and Afghanistan, our ventures into those are still very fresh. I mean, we're first now this past year leaving Iraq, and Afghanistan will be out of it in another year or so. And what are we leaving behind, and what will come of that is something that is not necessarily a pretty picture to look forward to. Iraq has again erupted into sectarian violence. We failed to recognize when we listened to Iraqis who had been in exile for 27 years and were telling us what can be done in Iraq. We failed to recognize that sectarian differences had been held in check during Saddam's years, but they've all erupted and they're continuing to this day. Afghanistan, where we went after 9/11, thinking, again, we could bring our form of democracy, set up a form of parliament among the Afghans, and bring the warlords, which has been the history of Afghanistan, bring them to be part of this parliamentary system and have a national Afghan federation. Well, that has worked in Kabul, particularly when you've got lots of Humvees and military people around. But most of these warlords are showing their true self, and they're hardly part of a national Afghan federation, but more they're seeing their opportunities now as warlords to take on a national level and enforce. So as we look at some of these areas, and now we look at Egypt, also rather fresh, where we again encouraged after Mubarak's fall free elections. And the results of these are also being seen today in the events in Egypt in the last month or so. Mohamed Morsi was elected freely and democratically. Democratically is, in our terms, free elections, supposedly without too much fraud. He was elected, but what he failed to do was to see that you get elected freely and democratically, but he chose not to rule democratically, instead trying to garner all the power of the judiciary under him rather than using the systems that a true democracy has. So in looking at all that, it raises the question, was it our intelligence that failed or our leaders who failed to listen to intelligence? The most glaring case, of course, that we could look at was the WMDs in Iraq, and now we're hearing what we should do in Syria. And it's much easier to go into a war than to get to extricate ourselves. So there are many things we've got to look at. Now, so far, I haven't painted a very happy story of that part of the world. And Christina mentioned the Commonwealth Club has a trip to Tunisia. So I want to try and give you a sense of what can work in the Middle East, what does seem to be working. And again, there's no template that makes things work. There's no template that works for everyone. But I think if there's any country, and I think even though I mentioned that before the revolution in Tunisia, when demonstrations started in 2010 of December, there was no political pundit who ever would have felt, who ever could have believed that Tunisia would have had a revolution, much less something that spawned these other countries. The so-called Arab Spring was not something that Tunisians thought as they started protesting. It was never in their mind to spawn a series of revolutions in other countries. They were simply looking for a change in their own life, to find the economy treated fairly throughout the country. But we have to look at what's going on in Tunisia to try and understand what is a revolution, what does that mean? How many people in this room have had the chance to live amidst a revolution and understand it? We do have a few hands. Well, I think we all have a concept of what is revolution, and we see pictures in the paper, and oftentimes we really don't understand what's happening on the ground. So I want to try and now bring you up to what's been happening in Tunisia, what is the revolution like there, and why do I say, and I'm not alone in saying this, about many political pundits who failed to see and could have possibly have seen in December 2010 why people are looking at Tunisia as a place of hope. It's very important that people who are working in Tunisia, the State Department's role in Tunisia, the European community, and as Peter mentioned in the introduction, there are projects that I've been fortunate to be involved in post-revolution Tunisia. And we learned some very painful lessons in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are being corrected this time in how we treat Tunisia. Iraq and Afghanistan, we gave hundreds of millions of dollars, and we gave it to Ahmed Chalabi, who was our point man when in Iraq, or to Hamid Karzai, and hundreds of millions of dollars given in cash, and where this money has ever gone to is something very few people know. And very little of it has really gone onto the grounds for sustainable projects that have yielded results over time and will yield results after we're gone. Those lessons were taken to heart in Tunisia and also in Europe, also in Egypt. But it's not for us as the Americans to police the world. But if we choose to be involved in helping, it's very important that we listen to what people on the ground need and try and not impose on what we feel should be done, as we tried to do in Algeria, Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, but to try and listen to the different parties involved and understand how to work. What is happening today in Tunisia, and it has happened since the revolution and since Ben Ali left in January 2011, is really quite interesting. Traffic flows, universities are open, water comes, electricity comes, it's there all the time. Tourism still comes, though there are ways when people stop coming because they had fears, oftentimes unknown fears. Oftentimes things happen in Egypt, and the ramifications are that people have the fear that it's happening, the same thing's happening in Tunisia. Something happens in Syria, people think it's over there, it's the same thing happening. But money, rather than going to the Tunisian government, has been going to NGOs, non-governmental organizations. People are listening. The American ambassadors who have been serving in Tunisia invite Tunisians from different walks of life, from civil society, to say, what is it you can use from us? How can we help you? And rather than simply giving to the government, a government who no one knows who will be 3 months later, the money has been going to help develop sustainable projects that can be monitored for financial transparency and also in terms of giving guidance in terms of how to develop. Tunisia is the country that never had free elections. So when you tell them, now you should go have free elections, you're free of the dictator. How would anyone know how to develop a party system? How would anyone know to develop an electoral system if you never had a chance to do it freely? Tunisians are now learning. There are organizations, some of them Americans, who are helping through Tunisian non-governmental organizations to, on the ground, set up the sustainable infrastructures to help Tunisians understand the voting process. Same thing with education. Things are improving in terms of the educational system rather than simply educating people. And Tunisia is very lucky. Even through with years of dictatorship, there was a value given to education. So Tunisia, unlike Egypt and some of the other countries, has a very high literacy rate. Some 90% of Tunisians are literate. University is something that is free to people, and people have been going through university. So it's an educated population. It's also a population that does not have sectarian differences. Almost everyone is of what's called the Malachi school of Islam, of Sunni Islam. It's a more liberal, open-minded thinking. Women, by law, are equal in Tunisia to men and have been since 1956. So there are elements that are ingrained in Tunisia society that were there before the revolution, that are allowing this kind of openness and opportunity to make something work. And it is happening. Now, this is not to say everything's perfect. They're squabbling every day in their Constitutional Assembly. The Constitutional Assembly is the body that was elected in October of 2011 to be the governing body to write the Constitution. They were charged with a mandate to write a constitution in a year, after which there would then be elections to hold, whether it would be a presidential system, prime minister system. And in this respect, an Islamic party was elected. An Islamic party was elected with a plurality of 42%, which means they didn't have a majority, but they had a plurality. Now, as a country, we've been saying, we learned from the Palestinian elections that I cited, we learned from Algeria, we learned from Iraq, that perhaps we have to let what free elections do, we have to let them take their course. This is what the process was in Egypt. Though Morsi, who was elected, chose not to, as I said, keep a democratic process in terms of governing. In Tunisia, the process has been democratic. But they're squabbling all the time. The Islamic Party wants to enter some of the things into society that they feel have the values of Islam. And then the secularists, who represented the non-42%, so 60, almost 60%, because they had no political background, they were varying 60%. They were not cohesive, other than the fact that they didn't want an Islamic government. So much like our Congress, which squabbles about whether people, some people say in our Congress there shouldn't be health care to all, some people say there should, despite the fact that someone walks into a school in this country and guns down students, or goes into a movie theater and guns down students, we still have people in Congress arguing against gun laws, arguing against reasons we should have still allow assault weapons. Tunisians are arguing every day, but they're arguing freely. Television at night, it used to be that no one would ever watch the news at 8 o'clock, the Tunisian news, because you knew there was nothing new. Now, it's a vibrant society, a vibrant press. Television every day after 8 o'clock, talk shows, people may not be talking with each other, they're often talking at each other, but they're talking freely. So there seems to be something moving on that's helping. I mentioned that some 42% of the body that was elected in Tunisia represented the Islamic Party, which is called Ennahda. It translates into the Renaissance. Ennahda is something that is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt. And Ennahda has been trying to shape the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution, in ways that bring in Islamic elements into the system, and there's a constant squabbling, and the result has been there's been nearly a delay in finishing the Constitution. And now we hear about demonstrations all the time, and the demonstrations are the free will of people speaking up and saying, we don't want this party, we want to see a change. But the important thing is, throughout all this, there's been no internecine violence. It's not Tunisians against one another. Americans are welcome. Europeans are welcome. The tourism still flows. And the result is facts are taking place on the ground that are building a civil society. Yes, not everything works in conferences every day. Not everything works in the government, but not everything works in our government so smoothly, as we see with a budget crisis that's causing a fiscal stop, possibly bringing a stop to our fiscal spending and a stop to our government. So things are happening in Tunisia, and things are happening in a way that people are finding their own way through the democratic process. And every month and every 6 months, they're learning more and more how a democratic process works. So on that note, I'd like to just say that we in the West have to start to understand that there's distinctions between the different places in the Middle East and North Africa. There are very many different elements, and the better we start to understand these differences between the different people of the Middle East and North Africa, the more we understand why some areas are more successful, because their educational level is higher, or more, we have to be more attuned to the sectarian differences, the better we can be partners in helping these countries build societies that, have viability and sustainability. In closing, I'd like to say that the region remains very volatile, but hopefully Tunisia can be a barometer by which we learn how to work with partners to truly help build a democratic society, and at the same time they are learning how to build a democratic society that is on the way of working. There are political frustrations, there are economic frustrations, but listening and talking is bringing about change. And truly, I think the words of Obama, President Obama, in his speech at the State of the Union, when he said, "We saw the same desire to be free in Tunisia where the will of the people proved more powerful than the writ of a dictator." This can be something that can really take place in Tunisia. And it's with great hope and optimism that I believe it will. And for those of you who have the opportunity to be able to participate in this trip, you will meet people throughout the society that really will show you the stereotypes that we often have about that part of the world, that women are ultra-conservative, that there's no free thinking, that religion plays a role that perhaps can be corrupting. Every society is different, and Tunisia is an opportunity to be able to experience and meet people who are making progress. And it reminds me of how we have often so, in closing, I'd like to just say we need to get over this idea of over there, that they're all one monolithic block. And it reminds me of a story of a flight that Abe Goldberg took from, he was at the South Pole vacationing, and he was going to go all the way to the north, to Alaska, and he was on the plane. And sitting next to him was an Asian man. And as they're flying from the South Pole to the North Pole, when they were near Hawaii, the pilot said, "If you look out on your left, you'll see Pearl Harbor." And Abe slapped this Asian man who was sitting next to him. And the man said, "Why did you slap me?" He said, "Pearl Harbor." The man said, I'm Korean. I had nothing to do with what happened. The flight goes further, and as it's approaching the North Pole, the pilot says, "If you look out there, you'll see an iceberg." Suddenly, the Asian man slaps Abe Goldberg. And Abe says, "Why did you do that?" He said, "Iceberg, Goldberg, you're all the same." So, as we look at that region, it's always important, as we try and correct the problems of the world, one thing to never lose is your optimism. And to me, I see glimmers of optimism in many parts of the world, and I particularly see it in Tunisia. I see it every day. And despite the fact that the news reports like to only cover a demonstration or only cover a political assassination, I think it's truly a laboratory for anyone who studies political science and wants to understand how the world might actually be improved. It's a very special place, and I'm happy to share these stories, and hopefully you'll have the chance to experience it yourself. And thank you for having me here.
Our thanks to Jerry Sorkin, specialist in Middle East and North African politics and tourism. And now we get more of the interactive portion of our evening. Some questions from the audience as well as from me. I think maybe I will start for a moment. First of all, thank you for ending with a joke. It's usually the old trope that you start with one, but I like that we ended with it. And I think Abe Goldberg is a relative of mine, actually. I'm curious, since you've lived so much of your adult years in Tunisia, what is it specifically about, whether it's the political culture or the intellectual culture or the history or the popular way of doing, of living Tunisian lives? What is it specifically about Tunisia that gives you hope that it can, in fact, be a kind of not only just a model for other other instances of democratic change, but simply a possible template for its own democratic processes?
It's a very good question. And I think it really goes back Tunisia's evolution over the years. I had, before I'd ever had visited Tunisia, and as Peter mentioned, it goes back over 30 years, I had traveled quite a bit through Jordan, Egypt, several times to Morocco, Iran, Turkey, Israel, the West Bank. And when I finally chose to go to Tunisia, I really didn't expect to see a country that was that different. I also felt they're all the same, that part of the world, they're all the same. And when I got to Tunisia, I saw people drove in the lanes, which was not typical if you've ever been to Cairo or Isfahan or Tehran. I got in a taxi. I didn't have to barter. He put on the flag and gave me my change. And those little things made me say, this country is different. I saw Tunisian women go at the beaches, Tunisian men and women holding hands walking down the street. And I started asking myself, and still ask this question even after 30 years, the same question Peter asked, what makes this country so different? And I have to say that education is probably the most crucial thing. And despite the autocracy that there was over the years in Tunisia, Tunisia's founder of independence was Habib Bourguiba, who was a secular Paris-trained lawyer. And he had a vision, and I think it's this vision that's so important. While countries like Algeria and Libya were having bloody wars throwing over their colonial past, Bourguiba's response was, in terms of the French protectorate, we can take what they offered, what they provided us that was good, and throw the rest away. Education was something they brought. Let's not throw that away. France became the major trading partner of Tunisia, and I think that vision of building clinics, making education the primary thing, I think is one of the primary areas. And I think as a result of that, Tunisians have an openness and a tolerance, and it's not simply a slogan, it's real.
This leads well into a question from our audience, a kind of a Tunisia 101 question. On what is Tunisia's economy based beyond oil?
Actually, oil, it's not based on oil at all. It's a country that has not been blessed with oil, and one would say that's also its blessing, because education is really what they needed. They had to be resourceful. Tourism has become the major economic arm of Tunisia. It's primarily not the type of tourism this tour will do, but primarily mass tourism, like going to Cancun, that type of tourism.
Cancun is in Tunisia.
No, but one doesn't go to Cancun to learn about Mexico, so that's what most people go to Tunisia, to lay on the beach, but they're missing all the things that are important. But that's the major bread earner. It's also a place, because it's educated and it's populous, it does a lot of, now it's doing a lot of high-tech work, back-office software work, call centers. So it's education, and the fact that almost all Tunisians are fluent in both Arabic and French. This education, to me, is most important. And we look at Egypt as a contrast. It's 30%, even after all these years, 30% illiteracy rate. So when you think of how can you have develop a democratic system when you have 30% of the people who can't read, these are factors that I think are very important to the openness of the society.
A follow-up from an audience member to what you just began to address. Here's what this person writes. Since we are in Silicon Valley, after all, or at least 40 miles north, or is San Francisco now a suburb of the valley? I think so. Since we are in Silicon Valley, after all, can you comment on entrepreneurial activities in Tunisia and perhaps other countries in the Middle East as well?
Okay. These are very good questions, and
I did not
plant these in the audience. entrepreneurialism is a new concept in Tunisia, relatively new. Privatization didn't come until the mid-1990s. So the government was really the mainstay, and this was partly an outgrowth of Bourguiba, who felt it was a poor country after the French left, and he felt to develop a country that was really third worldish, and you had to make things equal to all. So it had a kind of a socialistic initial development in terms of economy, and that meant you had bloated government involvement in all sectors. And in the mid-90s, privatization became more a drive. But the concept of entrepreneurialism is very new. And I'll give you just a brief example. Peter mentioned in the introduction of my role as a director of a program for George Washington University in Tunisia. Getting people to think as entrepreneurs is very difficult. People come out of university and they think, I have my degree. I'm waiting for the government to give me a job. What we're trying to do in our program and what many of the civil society groups are trying to do is teach people how to use the skills. Maybe what they learned in school can't be applied directly, but to try and think of ways they can creatively develop their own businesses. And the high-tech industry, remember, Tunisia and then subsequently the other countries, the revolution started with cell phones and Twitter and Facebook. So it's this technology that spawned, and this is a country where people can take that talent and now are doing it. But entrepreneurialism is still a new concept, getting people to wean away from the old way of the government will give you your job.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Jerry Sorkin, who is discussing Tunisia as a possible model for democracy movements in the Middle East. Jerry, I want to come back for a moment to some of the political challenges that you mentioned in your talk, including what in the West we think of as either extremist or hardline Islamic parties or movements that are beginning to have representation in the assembly in Tunisia. What can you say whether these movements are clearly popular enough to garner 42% of the seats? Are they embraced fully in terms of what is the connection between some of the social changes that or social reforms or restrictions that we associate with groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? What are the connections between those kinds of changes and what the Renaissance Party is proposing in Tunisia?
Well, the Renaissance Party is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. So in many ways, the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood of Tunisia shared a similar past, which was in both countries under Mubarak and also under Ben Ali, they were banned, or they were very limited in what they can do. So their organization building took place out of the country in absentia or in the prisons, and then when they were let go of prison and sent out of the country. So they developed organizational structures. So when the country had the revolution, in the case of Tunisia and also in Egypt, the one group of people who were organized were the Muslim Brotherhoods in Egypt and Tunisia, because no one else had an opportunity to have political organization under dictatorships. There were elections in Egypt, there were elections in Tunisia, but they were sham elections. They were trumped up and played up, and Mubarak or Ben Ali winning by 99% because he's so loved. So the Muslim Brotherhood was able to organize, and they knew how to reach out to the provinces and reach people. And that was why in both countries they won. Now, in the case of Tunisia, an interesting phenomenon, they did win 42%, which is not the majority, but it's the plurality. That majority, that difference, that 58%, were primarily leftist and centrist, but they didn't have parties. They had egos. There were many people. There were over 100 political parties on election day. So what you have is every Tom, Dick, and Harry, or every Mohammed, and Ahmed, who wanted to run, ran. But they didn't have the cohesiveness that the Brotherhood had. Many seculars were extremely disappointed when they were elected in Tunisia. They thought, now the clock is going to turn us back. We've really got a problem. And in this two-year period, they were only supposed to have the mandate for 1 year to write the Constitution, not to be a legislative body, but to write the Constitution. It's now been extended for 2 years because they have constantly tried the Ennahda, to put in features turning back the freedom of women, not so much the freedom, but calling it something different, calling it complementary to men as opposed to the law, which actually said they were equal. Trying to make a law that there should never be normalization with Israel. No country in the world makes their constitution based on another country. That has slowed things. But what's interesting now, the secularists, the centrists are saying, it's fortunate that Ennahda was elected because they've accomplished nothing economically. The country has gone down economically. Foreign investment has left. So now when we have an election, and the polls show this, people could say, what did they accomplish? In the meantime, in those 2 years, the centrists are becoming more organized under an umbrella organization called Nida Tunis. So in many ways, people are now saying it's fortunate they were elected, and they were elected freely, so they can never say what happened in Algeria or Palestine or elsewhere where the elections were thwarted. Hopefully, this is also a positive opportunity for Tunisia in the future.
Just to follow up on that, even the Ennahda party, it certainly isn't as hard line as we might see in some other Muslim countries. For example, I understand that there are women representatives in the constituent assembly representing that party. Is there a threat of any kind from a further right-wing or right-leaning Islamist party or parties?
There is. There are a group, and again, this is a difference between Egypt and Tunisia. There is a group much further to the extreme called Salafists, who are practitioners of a doctrinaire form of Sunni Islam that really adheres to Sharia. Now, in Egypt, the Salafists were allowed to be part of the electoral system. They won 25% of the vote. The Muslim Brotherhood won 25%, and the Muslim Brotherhood won 50%, and the secularists won 25%. The mistake of the secularists, 25% in Egypt, was they saw 75% was some Islamic, and they bowed out of their constitutional assembly and left everything to the Muslim Brotherhood and to the Salafists. In Tunisia, Salafists were not allowed to be an elected party. So the Muslim Brotherhood has that plurality, but there is this group of Salafists, the more extreme, who are looking for, and with things that have happened in Libya, things that have happened in Mali, things that have happened in Algeria, there are extremists throughout that region that are looking for every weak spot in which they can find a way to enter. So is there something to be concerned about if Salafists and the extremists are not watched and we don't have a clear understanding of what's happening? Yes, there's something to think about. Ennahda is accused by many, and perhaps rightfully so, of having been soft on them. But now
soft on not punishing
when there has been activities that were clearly inflamed and caused by what are seen as Salafists. Some people say it's because people from Ennahda, many of them serve time in prison. Now there's a revolution. They don't want to imprison someone else. But they also are seeing they're paying a political price for that. And in the last couple of months, there seem to be efforts that they are really trying to clamp down on the Salafists. And I should say, these Salafists in Tunisia are very small in number, but their acts can be provocative, so it has a louder voice, but they are probably very small in number.
Question from an audience member. What do you think are the realistic steps that the West and the Middle East need to take in order to foster democratic growth and stability within the region? Maybe we can specify this to Tunisia.
Okay. I would say the example that I gave during the talk of listening and giving the guidance and support through NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to build the civil society that works, to help people understand electoral systems and how they can use technology to help build political parties, how they can develop entrepreneurism. There's some wonderful projects taking place in Tunisia. There may even be some people in this room, because I know there's a San Francisco organization that's involved in supporting some of this, to teach women in poor areas that being an entrepreneur or having a micro business releases your dependency, to have a business as a seamstress, to have a business of making bridal gowns, to have a business where you make cheese and products. It doesn't have to be Apple computers. That having a business that can allow you to develop on your own is really a ticket to freedom. And women, and the reason I cite the example of these projects being women, history has shown in many of these regions that it's the woman, when she earns money, she uses it for her family, whereas when the men earn money, it often ends up playing card, you know, being used to play cards. So these type of projects are particularly important, and I think the more we give support in the European community, give support to education and micro-business development and political civil society, we'll see the successes that hopefully will come.
Turning slightly now to the sort of situation sort of among people and cultures, here's a question and a comment from an audience member. Night in Tunisia is a great jazz tune of world recognition, written long ago. What can you say, Jerry, about the arts and culture, its people that inspired, and the people that inspired this way back? The request is to please give us a greater feel for the people of Tunisia and what is so strikingly attractive then and what keeps it that way today.
Okay. Well, again, lots of good questions here. I think part of the answer I'll give will also dispel these stereotypes we often have about, this is a region of the country over there where they're fighting. It's dangerous. This past summer, there were two occasions that I attended a festival at Carthage, the Roman ruins. It has a beautiful Roman theater in Carthage, which is essentially today a suburb of Tunis. Every night there were jazz concerts, classical music concerts, Arabic classical music concerts, dance concerts, and Carthage was filled. And throughout Ramadan, which this year and previous years and subsequent years to come are in the summer months, the festivals of cultural events are just, every night there's something to do. So Tunisians have a history of music, poetry, art, craftsmanship, and these have been inspired in many ways over the years. Sometimes there was a musician who performs almost every summer who does jazz fusion and does not only with instruments but also with his voice. It came from the fact that he went to a Quranic school when he was a young boy and learned how to chant. Today, he apparently is against almost the practitioner of religion, but he uses his history to do this. Some of the artwork today that you see, the contemporary paintings in Tunisian galleries, is influenced by the art of calligraphy, which really rose through the years of the scribes writing the Quran. So there's a lot of art. There's architecture. Tunisia is taking on some of their own art, but much of it has been influenced by the different people who have lived in the region over the years. And some of it, the Roman ruins of Tunisia are the most expansive in the world and best preserved. And when you look at the Roman ruins and you see how intricate the mosaics are depicting life in Roman times with the fish and people, you can see that this has also inspired subsequent schools of art in Tunisia. So there's a lot of art and culture that comes through. And I think encouraging those type of things is also very important in keeping a peaceful society.
For centuries, Tunisia was also a small but important center of Jewish life, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and the changes that have happened and the attitudes, contemporary sure. attitudes in Tunisia toward Jews.
Well, I mentioned how before I ever went to Tunisia the first time, I had traveled rather extensively to some of these other countries. And in 1948, there were 1 million Jews throughout the Arab world. Today, there's probably less than 6,000 through the entire Arab world. So they, over waves of political periods, 1948, the establishment of Israel, 1956 with the rise of nationalism with Nasser in Egypt and the Ba'ath Party in Syria and Iraq, and the French in Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco. There was a real change, and that brought another wave of emigration. In some cases, the Jews left in fear, but in Tunisia, Jews didn't leave in fear. They didn't leave because they were thrown out, but they left primarily because they felt security wasn't going to be in their interest in the future. The same thing the French population, the Sicilian population, the Maltese population of Tunisia. People left because they didn't know, with revolutions happening in different countries, what would come. But one of the things that was on my first trip to Tunisia that was, to me, fascinating, I went to an island called Djerba, which is off the southeast coast of Tunisia. And there's still a very vibrant Jewish community on this island. And as I went into the jewelry district of the markets place, where most of the jewelers are Jewish, I noticed that they were wearing their kippah, the head covering, and they would have Jewish stars. There's no place in the Arab world today where you see people who can feel comfortable doing that. And when I saw that in Tunisia, I thought, what is making these people, not having left, but having a vibrant community, 12 synagogues operating daily, 1,000 people in one village alone, and the ability to feel comfortable in their skin. And again, I hearken it back to the things that I try and learn every day that I'm in Tunisia, is what makes this country different. And I have to say the openness and the tolerance, which comes through education and the fact that different civilizations have been there. And even today, people feared that maybe with the Islamic Revolution it would change, but it's not. The Jewish community is free. One of the members ran for an electoral position. He didn't win, but it's still a very comfortable situation.
I understand that also the day-to-day, the daily language of the Jewish community of Tunisia is Arabic.
In the south, it's Arabic. In the north, it's French. They're more Francophile.
What about contemporary attitudes or the experiences of Americans in Tunisia? And I will ask you to exclude yourself, since you are a bit of an unusual case, living much of the year there. What would Americans who travel there expect to find in the way of attitudes? And does it depend on which region of Tunisia one would travel to?
No, I would say, I mentioned kind of some statistics of how few Americans go. And Americans are really very welcome there. And I say that not just because of my own experience. I know there's some people here in the room tonight who have spent a year or more in Tunisia, and I'm sure they would say the same thing. It's interesting. We organized a group of Peace Corps volunteers who served in the 60s in Tunisia to go to Tunisia after the revolution. And Peace Corps volunteers, I don't know if any of you served in Peace Corps, there's a network that continues, but the Tunisian network of Peace Corps people is extremely strong. And there's a network of diplomats who've served in Tunisia over the years, and that network is extremely strong. And in all the cases, and I know many of these people, Tunisia left them with something. There was a Tunisian-ness, a passion that they developed for this country, for their country, and that stuck with them. And you don't find that necessarily with Peace Corps people who served in other countries, not to say there aren't some of those situations. But Tunisia, just there's something warm and welcoming, and I'm not using it to say fuzzy, nice things about it. It just happens to be the case. I think most Tunisians would find much more in common with Sicily and the lifestyle of Sicily or Malta than they would with anyone from Yemen or Saudi Arabia. There's just... it's Mediterranean, and with Mediterranean life comes the enjoyment of cafes and being with your family and music. So I think this is very present in society, and I know for Americans who serve there in the State Department, it is a very cushy post. So,
well, we had a comment from the audience about because we're in Silicon Valley, we should hear about entrepreneurship. But we were also in the foodie capital of the world. So I need to ask you, when you're in Tunisia, what do you eat?
The food is very healthy. It's not Middle Eastern food. Don't go there expecting falafel or hummus. And it's not Moroccan food. It really is its own. Fish is everywhere. Fresh fish is everywhere. And when you have fish, it is usually caught that day. If food is grilled, most of it is healthy. Vegetables are all fresh. There's no such thing of going to the market and seeing, apples from Chile or somewhere else. So everything is seasonal. So when we talk in this country, when the foodies talk about farm-to-table restaurants, that's what every restaurant is like in Tunisia and every home. It's literally farm-to-table. So it's very healthy food. What is lacking, if I want to be critical, there's not enough creative experience. You have new restaurants opening up all the time, but they're often doing what the other restaurants have done. What they need is more creative food. But the food is very good, and there's certainly lots of diversity.
So that
and good wines, I should say.
So that could be an entrepreneurial activity as well, as some sort of food revolution and not just a jasmine revolution. Coming back to the more the political affairs a little bit, you had mentioned in your talk that back in December 2010, no Tunisian pundit, let alone Tunisian citizen, would have imagined that Tunisia would become a kind of catalyst for a region-wide Arab Spring. But I'm wondering, since that has happened now, whether the self-image of Tunisians, activists, advocates, politicians, pundits, journalists, whether the self-image has changed, whether Tunisians take upon themselves a more bellwether kind of role, and how that expresses itself in daily life, in the newspapers, on TV, and so forth.
There is a great sense of pride among Tunisians that they were the first country. It's actually, to some of them, they feel that Egypt eclipsed it in terms of publicity and press shortly thereafter, because Egypt has always been the bigger country. But Tunisians will often be quick to remind you that it started with us. And I would say that they're very politically attuned to things. So when Ennahda tried to do things to tamper with the role of women, women came out a year ago in August in tremendous force throughout the country, joined by men. And they protested all the activities that Ennahda was trying to do, and all these things that Ennahda was trying to do were abrogated. So Tunisians are now politically sensitive. It's a new found freedom, and they're putting it, and I think they take a lot of pride in that.
Well, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question, or one or two thoughts and comments. I'm wondering if you could expand a bit on what you see, if you were to be a seer or a future prognosticator, what would a Tunisia of your imagination look like in 5 years, both politically? Obviously, you'd want a lot of people coming as tourists from the U.S., since you are heavily, you have a lot of at stake there personally. But as a society, what would you imagine in 5 years? Maybe you can give us a best and worst case scenarios.
Well, since I have involvement in a variety of things, I really can honestly say that I can take away my personal interest in that I want to see tourism survive, but it will anyhow. I think Tunisia will be a country that will, having a democracy takes time, and revolutions don't happen overnight, but I think it's a country that is going to be democratic. It isn't already, but I mean a working democratic country that has political systems that are transparent, that are progressive. And I think this will take time. I think it may take 3, 4, 5 years. But I think it will have all the attributes that always distinguished it before, the important role of women, the important role of education. And I think it will actually become a barometer by which other countries that are looking at, in the same way countries that then spawned what was called the Arab Spring, and I don't think that's really a good term, they can look at Tunisia and see how things can work and what they have to do. And I think it will continue, the democracy movement will only continue forward.
Just briefly following up on that, what do you think within Tunisia are the one or two key, either systemic, governmental process changes that need to adhere to make democracy feel like it's no longer an experiment, but a full-fledged, working, native, not just an ideal, but a practice.
I think what's lacking now is what's needed is there's not a clear sense of who's in charge, and I think that's part of what the Constitution has to determine. There's a prime minister who thinks he's in charge. There's a president who thinks he's in charge, and no one really takes charge. Things work, though. As I said, you know, trash is not picked up as frequently as it was during the dictatorial years, but it does get picked up. Schools open, maybe not always on time, but they open. The water's always flowing. The electricity's always coming. Utilities work. I think as these political systems work and the sense of stability, political stability, is more secure, I think the improvements will follow. And fortunately, education and the positive openness in lifestyle and desires by Tunisians that have been there all throughout pre-revolution and now post-revolution will only help further that more.
Well, our thanks to Jerry Sorkin, specialist in Middle East and North Africa politics and tourism, and thank you to our audience here and to those listening online. I'm Peter Stein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.